Martin Johnson, after leading your country to the World Cup, I'm sure there are thousands here in the Telstra Stadium and millions around the world who would just like to say congratulations.
Thanks, you know, it was a huge effort from the entire squad of players, our backroom staff, our coaching, everyone, our physios. Thanks to the fans, they've been brilliant.
Dawson goes through, makes a wonderful break. He's tackled 15 metres from the line. Back's there. Wilkinson will drop for goal. 55 seconds to go. This is the one. It's coming back for Johnny Wilkinson. He drops for World Cup glory.
Yes!
It's up. It's over. He's done it. Johnny Wilkinson is England's hero yet again.
And England staying composed here. Wilson still in place for the drop goal. Australia come back. Here it is for Johnny. Has he done it? He sure has. Heartbreaker for the Wallabies.
Hello and welcome to the Dilip Ram All-Rounder podcast. It's the 7th of February. It's around 7:40 p.m. And we are talking about the 2003 Rugby World Cup final between Australia and England, which was played at Stadium Australia in Homebush. My guest today is Michael Hope. We used to work together. He's a very talented employment lawyer applying his trade at my old firm. He's a sports connoisseur and just an all-round great bloke. We probably now have a more online relationship via some Facebook groups where we just continuously tag each other in memes and occasionally talk about rugby. But Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I've been a keen listener and was pleasantly surprised both by being invited on and also by the quality of the production that you've been putting out, Dilip. Been loving it, mate. Season one was great.
Well, I know you said you can't comment on this, but you are good for my diversity profile.
So I've been hearing.
So, Michael, before we get into it, if you could pick a sport that you wanted to be a professional athlete in, what would it be?
It's funny. This actually came up at a lunch the other day, just with colleagues. And I had a decent thought about it. And I just thought, in terms of what you put in, you know, attrition to the body, global fame, money. I mean, hard to go past 100 meter sprints.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Not the first thing that comes to mind. Not the cricket field, not soccer World Cups, not the rugby fields. I mean, rugby, I mean, I don't think I'm made for that. Well, I know I'm not, based on some very dismal returns in high school. But I mean, you know, think about it. The Olympics. Everyone looks at the calendar, when's the 100-meter sprint? And, you know, it's a nice mental image, you know, me just running, you know, just a couple of paces ahead of Usain Bolt to 9.1 seconds maybe, you know.
9.1 seconds. When I think about it, I think that it's a good choice because nobody misses the 100 meters. Who's the GOAT?
So, heart says Bradman, head says Messi. People sleep, I know this sounds ridiculous, but people sleep on Bradman. Like, cricket is a huge sport. I don't want to hear people say, oh, what does Jordan Bradman mean to someone in the USA? Like, okay, USA is one country and good for them. They obviously, you know, do well at sports, et cetera, et cetera. But cricket's a massive sport. It's like, I don't know, getting into lists and ranking things off the bat, but it's what maybe, it's in the top 10 easy of like globally played sports. And Bradman's record is like, I mean, come on, I don't have to say anything.
Yeah, it's, I think, part of it is also we live in a society which just focuses on the now.
Mm.
And
I know. And like, but Bradman wasn't playing scrubs, right?
No, he was. He wasn't playing carpenters and plumbers.
That's exactly right.
Sometimes when you look at that, you've got to say, what did you do against your competition? How'd your competition go? If it was so easy, then everyone was averaging 100.
That's exactly right.
So I love it. And I'm happy you didn't just say two cricketers. You said Bradman and Messi. Very good.
I mean, look, I like football too. not as passionately as some other sports. But, I mean, come on, Messi's CV. And I always thought that it was a pretty fair knock on him, the whole World Cup or international success. Like, that's completely legit. You have to do it all to be the GOAT. And, yeah, the recent World Cup, I mean, what can you say now? I was happy to see him streak ahead of Ronaldo because not a huge Ronnie fan, but...
Tapiano Pinado.
Exactly.
I love both. Well, Michael, I want to turn to the Rugby World Cup because that's what I brought you here for. And I want to shift back to 2003, which is the final. As I always say, it was a different time in the world and it was a different time in rugby. The Rugby World Cup was played in Australia. It was originally supposed to be a co-hosted tournament with Australia and New Zealand.
Yep.
And there were some issues with the IRB, the International Rugby Board at the time, with sponsorships, and New Zealand couldn't guarantee that they could remove all their sponsors from stadiums.
I think and look, you might get some anti-Kiwi bias throughout this podcast. So I'll just say it right now. Yep, I'm biased. I think my understanding of all that was just the Kiwis are unreasonable, so I got taken off them, you know, and they're still crying about it. So
they are. It was a World Cup where 48 matches were played. We had 20 nations competing. It started at Homebush Stadium, a packed crowd to watch Australia and Argentina play. Probably the biggest crowd I think the Argentinians have ever had for a rugby game. The mighty, I think, Felipe Contepomi was there in that team. And it finished with England over the advantage line, passing back to Johnny Wilkinson's right foot, which we can get into, for him to sink Australia's hearts and souls in a final.
Well, that's right. I mean, unfortunately, we are going to have to delve into that moment. I was wondering if we could get through a 2003 Rugby World Cup podcast without mentioning that. But I do think I'm going to have to engage with that moment.
Do you have personal memories of 2003 and that Rugby World Cup? What was your relationship with rugby at the time?
Yeah, so I was a young lad. I was 8 when that all happened. So not the most vivid memories, but I definitely remember pieces of it. So I grew up in northern New South Wales in a town called Yamba on the far north coast. And it's a pretty keen rugby town. We have the mighty Yamba Buccaneers. And we've had some Wallabies come through the ranks there. Kane Douglas and Jed Holloway.
Were they part of the Shoot Shield, as they call it?
They both came down to Sydney when they were finished high school. Jed even a bit beforehand.
Okay.
But so just to give a bit of a flavour, the Buccaneers, you know, a bit of a keen rugby town. Both my parents like rugby, so I was, you know, naturally inclined to get around it. And funnily enough, though, I was asking my parents about this the other day and they gave me the spiel, but I can't exactly remember the details. We had, for some reason, a huge, like, projector or screen near the local rugby field, which showed games for the Rugby World Cup. So it's actually a bit of a community vibe, community get together where I think it was for all Australia's games. I'm not sure which other games, probably just Australia's. And yeah, you'd head down there, picnic blanket, and watch Wallabies carve up. So it was a good time.
I suppose my memories, I'm a bit older than you. I was 13 at the time in 2003. Yep. I was in year 7. And my school, I went to Trinity, so it was a private school, but we played rugby.
Yeah.
And so rugby was sort of part of the culture and like what you would talk about. So when the Rugby World Cup came around, I just felt as if it brought a lot of Australia together. Even people who weren't necessarily rugby fans probably paid more attention to what was going on, given a lot of people from overseas came to Australia to watch a lot of these games, from Europe particularly.
Yep.
And I just remember being captivated by I didn't attend any of the games, but I just remember just always enjoying the fact that I think it was on Channel 7 at the time.
Hmm.
And just knowing that every night you could see two different nations play, and I'd heard about all these athletes that I hadn't actually seen before. So like players like Rupeni Thaotao, you just hear about we don't have YouTube back then. So at least I didn't have access to it. And Rupeni Thaotao, I'd heard about the kicking exploits of Johnny Wilkinson. And I was thinking, who's this bloke that everyone says is kicking 99% and doesn't miss a kick? And Colin Chavis from Wales. And I just heard of all these athletes. And I said, this is now a time that I can actually watch a lot of these players. it was a golden period, I think, Michael, for Australian sport. And when we look back at it, we say 2003, what was going on? Well, if you just step back, you say in summer, the Australian cricket team is probably at the peak of their powers in 2003. They've come off a World Cup in 99.
Yep.
They're dominating each summer
yep.
under Steve Waugh, McGrath, Warne. They've got a team that nobody can compete with. And so the Australian summer was always, you knew Australia's going to dominate. And they just won in 03 in the Cricket World Cup,
yeah,
which I've had some episodes on.
Undefeated.
Exactly.
World Cup.
Hadn't lost a game.
Didn't even get close. No one got close.
Not even close. And then you shift to the winter sports and Australian football, soccer, if I can say, they're, it's starting to be on the rise. The team is getting stronger. We find out in 05, 06, it's actually one of the better teams and a team that eventually qualifies for the World Cup. So you have that. But then I thought that rugby was in a particularly strong position in 03, particularly in Australia, because Australia just won the 99 World Cup. And off the back of that, they find out that they're hosting a World Cup, which we know and we can get into, brings a lot of money into the Australian eco-sporting system. And the team itself, whilst some players like John Eales and I think Tim Horan and some of the greats had retired in the early millennium, it was still a very strong team that had the support of an entire nation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and we'll get into the reasons why, but to draw a comparison between today's game and the 03 game, like rugby was really appealing. And not only that, the Rugby World Cup was really appealing. I'm sure people at the time drew comparisons between the Olympics and the 2003 World Cup, but it was a similar vibe, like in that, you know, a lot of countries from overseas coming down and supporting, but as much as that, people just getting around it and just really having an open mind. Like I talk to you know, people from around town or even down in Sydney, and they have memories of the 2003 World Cup. Oh yeah, we went to see that game. Might not have even been a Wallabies game, but yeah, people just wanted to support rugby and the event. I think, you know, rugby is a global game and people saw that this was a big deal and just, yeah, wanted a little slice of that.
The format for the Rugby World Cup in 03 actually shifted slightly from, it went back to an original format. So they had, it was four groups of five teams, and the top two teams qualified for the quarterfinals.
That's
and
right.
I think in 99 they adopted a completely different format, which was heavily criticized, where they had third place playoffs, and basically the general population were completely confused as to who would qualify.
Was
and
there they, issues with the amount of the gaps between games as well, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was like midweek games maybe. Yeah.
And they said, let's go back to a simple, tried and tested format.
Yep.
And that's what they went. And I think it paid off for them. In terms of the Rugby World Cup itself, my memories are, if we exclude the final, I thought there were a couple of few memorable games and a few memorable athletes. The memorable games for me prior to the final, you can't escape New Zealand-Wales.
Yes.
England, Samoa.
Yes.
And Fiji, Scotland. And the reason I say those three games, I thought the New Zealand Wales game, for anyone who hasn't watched it, I think it's on YouTube, the highlights of
it.
Yes,
it is.
It's one of those games where Wales were completely counted out. They're, at the time, their record against New Zealand was, I don't think they'd ever beaten New Zealand in a game, in a rugby match. And I don't think they've actually ever beaten New Zealand in a rugby match, even since, as at today's date.
Yeah, wow. Because, yeah, they had some good teams like way back when, but they definitely haven't in a long time.
So that was a 53-37 game. And I just remember the England-Samoa game also being entertaining just because the Pacific Island nations always play entertaining rugby.
Yep.
And
yeah, those two games took a similar play script in that it was the underdog came out hard, led not just 20 minutes in, but, you know, made the other team sweat.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the irresistible forces came home strong.
And it sort of gives rise to the first theme, which I saw from this World Cup and feeds into the final, which was this English dominance, which I think began from 2001. And England's 2003 win, I thought, was a culmination of 3 years of hard work, which saw them win the Six Nations titles in 2001, or it was 2000, 2001. France won in 2002, but the seeds were there. We saw a team that came to New Zealand, beat New Zealand in Wellington. They'd beaten Australia. They had a very intimidating forward pack and also enough backs that could scare opponents. You hear the names Lucy, Tindall,
Robinson,
and these are names that I still remember today just because of the impact they had on a team. I just thought it was a team that had a front line and a back line that probably they haven't had since.
No, absolutely. I mean, the stars aligned, plus there. It wasn't just a scary, huge, rumbling forward pack, and it wasn't just the devastating outside backs, but it was the precision of the halves. And I mean, this World Cup cemented Johnny Wilkinson as, you know, one of the all-time greats. And I mean, I don't think I would have too many people argue with me to say the greatest World Cup performance that rugby's ever seen.
It's funny because I hadn't seen Johnny Wilkinson before. I'd only seen those, maybe some clips on TV saying, hey, this is the best fly half in the game. And I think Dan Carter wasn't around at the time. And we had Stephen Larkin from an Australian perspective, but he didn't kick goals. So you almost felt like he was a fly half, but we always assume fly halves kick goals as well. At least that's naturally what they do.
A fino fly half in name only.
exactly. Yes. And so I just remember being just wanting to see him in action. And he's one of those, it's a weird one because he, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was a very, like, he's a great defender.
Mm.
And but he wasn't one of those players that would constantly break the line or throw these huge cutout passes that was going, you know, like in the Joey Johns, I'm using a league, yes. league analogy, but he wasn't that sort of player, but he was a great player because he didn't make mistakes and he fit that spirit of the ethos of that England team at the time, which was, we don't make mistakes. We're very good defensively. And we'll just, it's very similar to like the South African style,
yes,
of today's generation.
That's right. I mean, obviously what comes to mind first and foremost is the kicking. He was the drop goal lord. but not only that, off the tee, he was insane. But beyond that, like, yeah, a Marshall, defensively very strong. I think kicking around the park had a big boot, but I think he had Tindall there to share with the team. But by the same token, also, you know, no one's going to say that he had the passing game of a Larkham or I wanted to say a Carlos Spencer, but
I think Larkham, when I think of great passes in Union, I think of Stephen Larkham.
Oh, not only the end result, but just looking at it.
Like, he always attacked the line.
Yes.
And you love to see that in Union when you attack the advantage line and you're always going ahead, going forward. That was Larkham for you. Yeah.
I just remember, like, I grew up on Larkham at 10, so I didn't know any different for a lot of my rugby fandom days. And it was, it was never anything too lightning quick, but he'd get the ball in his hands, he'd sort of wander towards the line and you'd be like, okay, he's probably about to get bopped. But it's like a surfer coming on the other side of a wave. He'd be through the line and he'd be dancing, whether it's a step or a cutout ball. And it's like, oh, how did that happen?
Deservedly, it's good that he won a World Cup in 99.
Yes.
For his career. I feel like he gets forgotten a little bit in, maybe it's just as years have gone by.
Yeah, it's a long time, right?
Yeah. But when I think of Wilkinson, I think just if we fast forward as well, we 2003 was probably the apex of his career. And
yes,
we'll get into the final, but it's a some sort of a shame that we never really saw him on the world stage much after that. He played in 07 and miraculously England also make the final in 2007, comprehensively beaten by South Africa. Not comprehensively, but they lose to South Africa. Yep. But I thought Johnny Wilkinson was that one of those players that might have elevated to a true global superstar, a global icon in the to the likes of Jonah Lomu.
Yes.
And but he never reached that, and I think injuries hurt him.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He got banged up big time. Because I think, from 2003 onwards, I was pretty locked into rugby, thanks in large part to how good this World Cup was. And after that, you know, you'd be like, whenever Australia played, where's Wilkinson?
Yeah.
Is Wilkinson playing? Check the team sheet. Why? Because, it was probably for me, I was pretty young, pre-internet days, so you'd sort of put the TV on and the team sheet's in front of you. You're not reading up on, has he got injured playing for the Wasps or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he played for the Wasps. Wasn't too big on the English Premiership back then.
But he actually made a, he got injured for so many years that he then moved, I think it was Toulon, or he moved to France.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And became a superstar there, but it was in anonymity because it's not like people from the Southern Hemisphere are going to take notice of what's happening in the domestic league in France.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm sure that many of the French rugby fanatics have very fond memories of Johnny.
Of course.
But what does that mean to me?
Exactly. It's all about me.
Exactly.
It's another theme that I thought when I was putting myself back and rewinding and saying what was happening in 03, I think it's worth talking about, Michael, was the impact. And mention it, the impact of this World Cup on Australian rugby. And at the end of this episode, we're going to talk about the current day rugby and the struggles with current day rugby. We've got a Rugby World Cup coming up. But in 03, I was reading an article in the AFR. Sometimes if you just Google Rugby World Cup 03, you get these old articles that are still available. And it was an article written by John Stensholt in 2002. And he said that since the win in 1991, when Australia won the World Cup, rugby has chased the goal of becoming Australia's main winter sport. And this is what he wrote in 2002. And he spoke about the ARU receiving its highest ever net revenue at the time and having record crowds, sponsorship revenues, and really wanting to compete with rugby league and AFL as being the number one sport or number one code in winter sport. Now, that's the period we're talking about in rugby, and it's a period where people like you and I, we are looking at the sport and saying we are big rugby fans. So it's very different to the modern day environment, but it just says how much or how prosperous rugby union was back then, that it was legitimately thinking that it could be the number one winter sport.
Yeah, that's right. And it had a real moment. And that was really unfortunately, looking back, that was the apex mountain. That was that was the Everest for rugby in Australia. I mean,
it's a little bit sad.
It's very sad. Yeah. The 90s was great for rugby too. I mean, I shouldn't discount that. But I mean, this was a time where you had the game had fairly recently became professional, having 95, 96. Super rugby was finding its legs, although it had been, around for a while. You had a home World Cup, which, I mean, you can't even begin to say what that does for a nation's interest. And not only that, you have the home nation making the final in the Rugby World Cup with a bunch of guys who were household names. And this was a bunch of guys that weren't even in the 99 World Cup, but for, I think, from the starting team, Gregan and Larkham were played both 99. 2003, there was some subs as well. But this was, in large part, a new team with big names making a name for themselves on the biggest stage. And I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know every little reason why the game's dropped off since, but I think, anyone could tell you that it has.
Yeah, and I want to explore it later because I think there are some decisions that were made around that time with the money that they received that hurt them financially, but we can get into that. It was a World Cup. It brought $200 million. Well, I think $200 million was made in ticket revenue. 91% of all the available tickets were sold.
Wow.
And 120,000 Australian jerseys were purchased across the country.
I think you still see a few of those around today.
Yeah. 120,000 jerseys were purchased. It was when their final numbers were tallied up, I think it was around 80,000 tourists visited Australia for that tournament, which is sensational.
Yes.
Briefly on the aftermath, I mean, somewhat ironic, we're talking about the aftermath before we get into hot seat, but it was a huge result for England. Clive Woodward spoke about how important it was for English rugby and it being the first World Cup that a Northern Hemisphere nation had won. And I think they're still the only, Northern Hemisphere nation that's won a World Cup, which is interesting. It might say a lot about the style of rugby that was being played. But I think I just remember seeing a lot of the Australian players, probably they were at the start of their career, and I think they had this expectation that they will just rock up to the next World Cup, make a final, and they will make amends. But it's a funny sport, rugby. You've got to really take advantage of it when you can, because you never know when you'll next be in a final. And a lot of those players never saw another final.
Well, that's right. I mean, you could almost forgive that sort of worldview, given that 91, we rock up, get it done. 99, rock up, get it done. And I think the psyche, which probably played hand in hand with the amateur nature of the game, particularly in 91, didn't lend itself to the harsh environment of what you speak, where, like, I'm not going to say that, oh yeah, like they've literally just rocked up and won, but it was a very different game and a lot more. It's not going to be controversial to say that England's preparation and how they got the 03 World Cup, as a collective from start to finish, obviously more went into that than the 1991 World Cup.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of the game.
Yeah. Their preparation was perfect. They had a 2-year period where they were beating New Zealand, they were beating Australia, and if you can beat, and South Africa, if you're beating the Southern Hemisphere teams, you're in good stead.
Yes.
Hot seat, Michael. It's somewhat an extension of some of the themes we were talking about. The first hot seat I had New Zealand rugby as a hot seat.
100%.
Now, I had them as a hot seat because having lost to France in 99, somewhat surprisingly, in a game where you know, the French can always have this odd game where they bring out the flair and they play well.
Yep.
That period between 99 and 03, I think personally was one of the weaker New Zealand periods, where it was actually the first, they lost twice to England. Australia was in a period where they were retaining Bledisloe Cups.
Yes.
In that period where they were routinely beating New Zealand. And I thought the loss in that semi-final probably was one of the big reasons it was a big issue for New Zealand rugby, because the public is so demanding in New Zealand. They expect a World Cup each time. And I thought that was one of the weaker, that 2002 to around 2007 was one of the weaker periods in New Zealand rugby.
Yeah, it's funny. They just couldn't get it done. Like, I'm not the authority on New Zealand rugby from any earlier than that time, definitely, just because I was too young. But the team they put out was like, it was strong.
Yeah.
And obviously the results didn't reflect that, but it was a great team. And I think they also had great teams. They had a great team in the 07 World Cup, and it was once again cursed. So it was a funny time for New Zealand rugby, 100% on the hot seat. I mean, they had won one World Cup in 1987, which, I mean,
nobody remembers that.
No one counts
the
that.
The 80s.
I think it was like an invitational or something. I'm surprised there
anyone
gets
there?
Proper stat. You don't hear much. I think it was all black and white, and they've lost most of the footage. They should do a recount on that one.
I agree. It was a weak moment for New Zealand rugby. But as we've seen since, they've come back strong. They won in 2011. They won in 2015.
Yep.
They've been a force ever since. But I think that was one of the weaker periods. The other hot seat I had was code hopping. Now, I had that as a hot seat because this was a World Cup where rugby union was truly the sport that was attracting a lot of rugby league players. And we had, in the Wallabies team, we had Matt Rogers. We had Lottie Takiri.
Yes.
We had Wendell Saylor.
Yes.
And I think at the time, I just, I think both of us, at least for me, I had this view, having watched a lot of league at the time, which was if you were truly a great league player, then the next step for global fame was to actually move across and play Union.
Yeah.
Where you could actually become a global superstar.
Yep.
I mean, that those days are now gone. But I thought it was on the hot seat because Union was really the sport that everyone wanted to play.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because... I was, once again, younger then, I never put too much thought into it. I just thought, oh, how good's this? We've got like Matty Rogers, his approval ratings through the roof, but everyone loved him. And as with Lottie, I mean, Wendell, I don't know if we ever wore, I mean, Wendell had his crowd.
Yeah. I mean, he had a few issues, substance issues, but yeah.
I'd say it's funny because you said the sort of the reasoning behind the moves to become global superstars, and that makes a lot of sense. And you're actually... You're still seeing that in the New Zealand game a bit because obviously the pinnacle in New Zealand is Union. You've seen, there's been a few, but Roger Tavasashek had a crack, but not to much luck. I'm trying to think, there's been some other recent code hoppers.
The problem nowadays, I think, is we don't have as much patience nowadays as we might have in the past. And there's good and bad things about that. But I think nowadays, if it doesn't seem like a move is working immediately, we think, let me go back to the tried and tested.
Yeah.
So a lot of these players nowadays will give it a crack. And Union's a very different sport. You're not going to achieve the same. Like Sonny Bill Williams, who was a code hopper, took him, I would say, 20 test matches in the team before he really found himself and found his feet and was able to make a true impact on the game. And that's probably nowadays. Whereas back then... If you made the move, you legitimately were in it for the next few years.
Yes. Sonny Bill, awesome player. And even still, as good as he was and whatnot, like he made the position in his own at times, but he never really elevated himself from the great centres.
But it was tough. He was playing behind Conrad Smith and Manu. You're not displacing those. The other hot seat I had, and I'm interested if you had any, I had just refereeing. And I think I could include refereeing for any Rugby World Cup final and any Rugby World Cup because rugby union is that one sport where the match is completely or almost dictated by the referee's whistle.
Yeah.
If you have a referee that's happy for play to go on, then you have teams take advantage of certain rules because they know the referee wants to embrace a free-flowing style. But it's completely dependent on the referee. And the referee that was appointed for the Rugby World Cup final was Andre Watson. He had refereed, I think, the 99 World Cup final. And he was a South African referee, very knowledgeable about scrums, given South Africa's history, being a very strong scrummaging team. It's ironic because we'll find out when we go through best moments that he ended up penalizing the stronger team, the stronger scrummaging team. But... I thought refereeing was on the hot seat because as you move into any World Cup final, the excuses are always there for the losing team that the referee blew their whistle too many times. And we'll find out there were actually quite a few penalties in this game, but I thought most of them, we can get into it. Some of them were deserved, some maybe not. I wanted to talk about some rule changes, but let's talk about that when we finish best moments, because let's get into best moments.
Robinson! They won't catch him! Balls it into the crowd. England with a lethal blow in the shadows of halftime.
It's a good run early on by Will Greenwood. And then Delalio, look at him look inside, draw Sala and pick up Wilkinson. And Wilkinson puts the ball out in front of Robinson. And he makes sure by sliding early for his 16th test try.
Look at the year you beauty.
Top moments, Michael. Before we get into that, we were just talking in the break about how different the rugby was back in 03 compared to the modern day. And two things popped to mind, which we spoke about. One was box kicks and how frequently scrum halves utilize a box kick nowadays. When you watch South Africa play, New Zealand play, every nation, their scrum half, if they can't kick, they basically won't make the team. And the other being the use of yellow and red cards. Now, this final... we will, ironically, none of the moments include or involve a yellow or a red card for me. But it's just ironic how the game has changed, where back then we weren't worrying about head contact. And I think in some ways it's good the way the sport's moved towards safer rugby. But this was a different era where you weren't sort of concussions and head injuries weren't front and center of the news. It hadn't been fully researched and fully thought about. So it was just a very different style of rugby that was being played.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, on the latter point you made around concussions, it's obviously like tragic, but the legacy of England's 2003 World Cup win is a lot of those players have come out since and spoken of the impact that concussions and head injuries have had on them. And there's no ignoring that. And that's very much part of the reason why we are where we are today with interpretation or the rules as they are. But obviously if you're going to put player health to the side, which you can't, but it hurts the spectacle.
Yes.
But you have to come down on it seriously. So it's an awkward line space.
It is. Yeah, it completely is, because it's a sport where they don't wear helmets.
Mm.
So the players are vulnerable.
Yes.
And the rugby board wants to be seen to be proactive in protecting players. But then it does damage the sport as a spectacle, because you are constantly thinking about each tackle and whether it's above the shoulder, then whether it's a yellow or red card. And then it leads to doubt. So all we're saying is in 2003, when you watch a game, none of these issues were really at the forefront.
If someone came and shoulder charged someone square in the middle of the head,
you get a standing ovation
and maybe a yellow card for your troubles.
We shouldn't be like, but that's how it was in 2003. It was a completely different game. Okay, so my moments, Michael, I had four moments, and I'm hoping that my moments clearly, if I missed one, then I want you to jump in. But the first one I had was Lo Takiri's try.
Yep, that's a gimme.
It was a setup by a beautiful Stephen Larkham crossfield kick. And it sort of was a surprising play, because I had assumed England would take charge of the match and perhaps score with some penalties. But Australia just starting out early, starting aggressively, adopting a crossfield kick, going to Jason Robinson's line, knowing that he was a shorter player and Lottie could mark, catch a ball from his rugby league days. It's a great way to start the final.
Yeah, 100%. And to sort of set the scene, it's a drizzly night in old Sydney town, which probably isn't conducive to sort of big raking, booming crossfield kicks up to Lottie. But obviously that was the game plan. They crunched a lot of film in the weeks leading up to it. And yeah, I think I'll look... I haven't read anything to say this is fact, but I think, you know, Eddie Jones could probably mark that one down as...
Yeah. Eddie Jones, who was the coach of the Wallabies at the time, he's a coach that's known for setting up some genius plays that he devises for each of his teams. I think when he coached Japan in, was it 2015 or 2019, where they beat South Africa, a lot of the tries that Japan scored were... just genius plays that were, they clearly you could see that he had some involvement
in 100%.
How they were constructed. He was a great tactician. He was the coach of Wallabies at the time. And yeah, you could see that was a play that he'd probably told the boys to implement early on.
And you wouldn't need to tell Larkham twice, would you? If he thought it was a good idea, that would be stored in the old memory bank for 100 years.
Exactly. So Australia take a lead. And then the game... it sort of then becomes a game that England were more comfortable playing. It slows up. England gets some penalties. Wilkinson no doubt converts them. His reputation as being a sniper in front of the goals was solidified. And then my next moment, Michael, was then the next try, which was Jason Robinson's try. Because I had it because it was a great try, and it sort of cemented Robinson as one of the speedsters of the game, because he runs pretty much 30 meters down the left-hand side.
Yep.
They can't beat him, and it signaled a very positive end to a first half for England.
Yeah, that's right. So they're up 6-5, courtesy of the penalty goals. It's it's a classic sort of late in the first half. The Wallabies are a bit run off their feet. There's been a line out on the far side, and as there's a ruck and the ball starts to get spun out, you just look, there's no Wallabies there. I think Sterling Mortlock's waving his arms going, boys. And just simple, I believe it's just hands through the hands, and yeah, you don't need to give Jason Robinson a second look here, off to the races.
And he had that reputation as a speedster, as a player who, if you got him in space, you wouldn't be able to catch him.
Yeah.
And that, so he's just solidified that on the world stage in front of 82,000 odd people. So England go into the half, I think, was it 14-5? They're 14-5 up at halftime. And you think, well, it's going to be tough for Australia to come back here. But because I think Johnny actually misses that conversion, which is surprising. It's it could have been 16-5. It goes 14-5. And then I thought that second half was a second half where England played not to lose, because they knew that they had a team that could stop Australia from scoring. They almost felt confident. We're not going to let Australia score. They've had this great play at the start, but they're not going to find a way through. But then the game changed in a way, and I was listening to, so I think it's either Justin or Jason Leonard, the English prop, and he was recounting how after halftime, Andre Watson, the referee, started changing the way in which he was speaking to the players about some of the scrummaging that was going on. So at the time, if we rewind, England were the dominant scrummaging team. They knew they had the players. They knew that they could out-scrummage Australia. And Andre Watson was allowing them to do that. And then we've seen that second half, he started penalizing England for over-scrummaging. And England were basically befuddled or mystified as to why they were being penalized.
Yeah, I as a young buck watching that, I think it was just the and unfortunately this is an experience that I think a lot of fans endure. It's the great scrum lottery where the ball goes in, the ball rocks around, goes obviously to the attacking team, and then you watch the ref and see what he does. Ping, opposing team penalty, ping, feeding team penalty.
And you have no idea.
No. And look, as much as I say that was my experience as a young one, I got to say, look, I know a little bit more now, but it's still mystifies me a lot of the time. But we'll get on to that later on. But
I think I've seen 500 scrums and I still will not understand why a referee calls it for a certain
team.
Well,
the way I say it is that, you know, whichever team buckles first should, like, get penalized. But if that buckling is a result of illegal scrimmaging, well, then they may be awarded the penalty. And with the angle you see on TV, like, you can't tell, like, with hinging and, you know, time of engagement, like, it's you actually can't form an opinion a lot of the time based on one angle. And, you know, and that's I got to say, the refs in the same boat, they only see one side of it. But, I mean, getting into scrum rants is, you know, we'll say that till later. But I think, and another comment on in terms of the momentum in the second half, there was the scrums are like a huge flashpoint after the game as well. As a lot of criticism. Imagine how much criticism there would have been if they lost the World Cup. Obviously, you just get swept under the carpet a bit because they got away with it. But whinging poms and all that.
I know.
But it was even the best teams like this English team. You get the wobbles in the second half when you're looking at the Webb Ellis Cup. Like, it's impossible. There's knock-ons.
Yeah.
There's, you know, balls come off the side of the boot. It's a final. There's 80,000 plus fans, you know, going nuts.
Mostly, like, Australian.
Yeah, mostly Australian, but a fair English contingent as well. But, obviously the occasion didn't get to them, but it's you can't make it out of a World Cup final without mistakes. And that showed in the second half.
No, good call. And the second best moment I had, it was in the final minute. Yeah. And it was when Andre Watson, he raises his arm, signals a penalty against England for illegal scrummaging. And he'd ruled that Trevor Woodman had not engaged correctly at the scrum. It led to 3 points from our man inside center, Elton Flatley. That penalty, along with a couple of other penalties that Andre Watson had ruled in favour of Australia. It led to a post-match inquiry from the English press who were befuddled as to how the stronger team could be penalised. That kick that Flatley makes under pressure brings it to 14-all and leads us to extra time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, clutch moment. It's a tragedy of the sport that if obviously Australia go on to win it, that's played, you know, so many times over and over again as the moment which got us a sniff, got us another chance. But, you know, having gone back and, you know, watched the highlights and whatnot for this podcast, like, that doesn't rate a mention in the collective psyche.
I don't think Elton Flatley ever gets mentioned in rugby parlance.
Like, I think, you know, my family, like my parents and my sister and I, we loved Elton Flatley. Like, I don't know, you have your sort of favourite players as a family. Like, he just seemed like an absolute, like, gentleman as well. Like, great bloke, awesome guy, great with the boot, and really just great player all around. But, yeah, it just doesn't get his raps. I mean, that's the difference between being in a World Cup winning squad and being in a squad which gets to the final and doesn't take home the chockies.
If we put ourselves in the 2003 context, Australia, the Australian public is a very demanding public in terms of what it expects from its athletes. And the cricketers always win was the mantra.
Well, I mean, Australians could afford to be picky.
Yeah.
You know, we had, as you say, cricket, which is a huge sport.
AFL, rugby league, domestic leagues, but we're dominant.
It's the pinnacle, right? People like watching the pinnacle. We had the 2000 Olympics where we had our fair share of gold.
Exactly.
People are saying, oh, why should I have to support a team which doesn't get it done? Like,
yeah. And that's somewhat reflective in players like Elton Flatley probably not getting the same exposure as other athletes that won. But
yeah, I mean, look at, bit of a gut punch for Ireland, but like they've never made it past a quarter final, and they've got guys like, you know, Brian O'Driscoll, Ronan O'Gara, who are just like absolute legends.
You'll never forget them.
Yeah, and like, and also global superstars, but it's the expectation, right?
Yeah. I mentioned this on an earlier podcast, but it's ironic that the way in which sports is treated nowadays, like Australia wins the 2023 Cricket World Cup and Cummins and they come back to Australia and there's three people at the airport.
I know. I was watching it live.
Hoping a ticket tech, there would be a ticket tech parade.
I know. They'll say that on the grade cricket. I was like, yes, because I mean, I think when the Socceroos qualified for the 2014 World Cup, I know it wasn't a big one, but it just for personal experience, like they did so. It must have been, the game was in Sydney. Then the next day,
it was at Martin Place.
Yeah. They
had
like
a function.
Was like a not open bus, but the players were like there. There was like thousands of people rocked up, and that was just for that. So I was like, we just won the Cricket World Cup, guys. Like, get around it.
So it's more reflecting on the time, how demanding the public was in 2003. My number one moment, Michael, we can't escape it. I know we've taken probably 50 minutes to get here, but that World Cup will be remembered for one moment, which is the dropkick by Johnny Wilkinson. I think there was this expectation or that people knew that they were setting up for a dropkick because they weren't that close to the line that you thought maybe a try was in the offering, but they were that sort of 20 meters out that in rugby union, you think, what are you setting up for? You're either setting up for a penalty or a dropkick.
Yes.
And we knew with Wilkinson there, this was his crowning moment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, stop me if you've heard this one before. Like, this was a team that was so trigger happy on the drop goal. Wilkinson, like, I mean, you can't, like, it's all been said before, but I think we're talking about the Samoa game before. I was the highlights of that, like, there's a ruck where I think they're down 20-22, but down 2 points. He forget about box kicks. He essentially box kicks a drop goal from the back of a ruck straight through the post. Like, he was like, give me drop goals. Like, I've never seen it. And it's funny, that was like a bit of its own moment in rugby history, because the drop goals certainly been utilized since, and I mean, utilized but probably a bit less beforehand. I know that South Africa have had some very willing drop kickers since.
Mornay Steyn comes from, or Francois
from the sideline, 50 out, no worries. But But no one's actually implemented that game plan in a World Cup since, which is interesting. I mean, I think everyone watching that, whether they're English or Australian, it was a matter of when, not if.
And it's ironic that he kicks it off his right foot.
Yeah. I think that's almost like, yeah, because I can.
Yeah. He was equally able to do it off both feet. Yep. And Andre Watson, the referee, was asked about that moment because he actually said that Australia was woefully offside.
Yeah.
At the time at the ruck. And he knew that he was going to be asked to call a penalty.
Yep.
And in front of this raucous crowd, he actually talks about how he didn't want to be the center of attention and he didn't want the final to be decided by a penalty. But he said, at the end of the day, I'm a referee. I'm fine with calling that. But when he saw the ball get passed back to Wilkinson, inside his hope was that Wilkinson would make the kick so that would be the triumphant moment for the World Cup rather than a whistle and a penalty.
Yeah, and I can completely empathize with that. I mean, they say, oh, you know, ref, there's a rule book there. You're there to enforce it. Doesn't matter if it's the first minute or the 80th or the end of extra time. But it's like, come on. Like, swallowing the whistle is a global phenomenon and for good reason. No, you don't want to be the guy. And, yeah, I guess as fate turned out, like, yeah, I'm glad he's happy.
Exactly. In 2015, Wilkinson's drop goal was voted rugby's greatest moment or Rugby World Cup's greatest moment. And if I'm being honest, it probably would remain that way because there hasn't been a game since that or a final that's been decided by such a clutch moment.
Yeah, it's certainly the most iconic. And as you say, to win a World Cup final last minute of extra time through a drop goal, I mean, what's the comparison there? Like,
yeah, there's no comparison.
Yeah, not in a final.
And I was reading somewhere that the England win the World Cup and they actually end up at Cargo Bar.
Did not know that.
Because when you think about it, it's funny because you think of a World Cup, you always assume it's overseas, but this was in Australia and it's Homebush Stadium. And my experience with Homebush Stadium is there's nothing around there. So if you want to enjoy yourself, you've got to get out of Homebush Stadium. So I think I was reading some interview from some of the English rugby players at the time, Greenwood and Lucy and a few others. They end up at Cargo Bar. Brett Lee, Damian Martin are all there. And the English rugby team's there. I think maybe people at Cargo Bar probably didn't even recognize half those players.
That's fair. Yeah.
That's how they celebrated. I wanted to share some stats with you, some would you believe that's from this World Cup. Funny, the semifinals and finals, no team scored more than one try.
Yeah, yeah. Semifinals, finals, the World Cup's four very strong teams.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, you're not going to be throwing cutouts.
No red cards issued in that World Cup and 28 yellow cards were issued in those 48 games.
Oh, yeah, no red cards in the entire.
The entire World Cup. It's just sort of a very different game we had. Almost 83% of tries were preceded by three or fewer second phases. I got a few of these stats from, I was on Google.
Yeah.
And there was this, I think it was IRB Rugby World Cup review insight document prepared by IRB, by the IRB.
Yep.
And they were basically reviewing the World Cup and that's one of the stats that came out. So I thought that was a weird stat, but
I think that was just because when you took the 142-0 Wallabies against Namibia and the 90-8 Wallabies against Romania, there wasn't many tries left.
Yeah. Well, of the 332 tries, over half of them came from set pieces of line-out and scrum, and 23% started from within the scoring team's own half.
Oh, wow. Oh, I had a couple of weird and wackies.
Yeah.
Okay, just back to the final. A moment for Mike Catt having the audacity to try and hit a drop goal in extra time. That's wacky, mate.
You've got Wilkinson in your team.
What's he thinking?
It's not your role.
Yeah.
It's stay in your lane.
I know. So, okay, it's a bit incestuous, but imagine we're at court. High court, the barrister's just cooking. You know, when we were a junior solicitor, we just stand up and just start telling the judge, "Your Honor, no, forget about the barrister. I've come up with some good ideas. Here they are."
I think we'd be kicked out.
And my cat probably should have been kicked out. Yeah. And the other one I had was Fiji, USA, group stage game. Fiji ended up with the win, but USA scored right on the 80th minute and had a kick to win against Fiji, which would have been huge for them. And I mean, they're sort of seen as a, you know, a work in progress, like a potential superpower. Clearly, obviously got the athleticism. I think they got a few things going in college rugby.
Yep.
Sort of on that pathway, but they didn't make the last World Cup. Like,
they didn't. They didn't, and it actually lends into the theme I want to finish with you about modern day rugby. But on the US, that's a good point, because I think they've got the 2031 World Cup.
Yes,
and there's some questions about whether they can actually host it or whether people will actually attend. Mm. But the US market's very similar to the Australian market, which is, we have so many sports that we're only going to support the teams that actually do well for us. And your that example, I do have some sympathy for the US rugby, because as we know, you need to have a culture of rugby in order to play good rugby, and they need to start winning games. But that was probably, if had they won that, maybe
started something great.
It started something. Michael, I brought you on also to get an insight from you about the modern day of rugby. I think when we look back at 2003, we can probably say, we both can say it was a golden era for rugby and our enjoyment of rugby in Australia. And that's why we've done an episode on the 2003 final. And I think we've done justice to it, but it stands in stark contrast to the world in which we live in and the rugby world, which we live in, and the state of the game. I want to get a sense from you. How do you generally feel about the game?
All right. So, yeah, I'm a tragic. Like, I love rugby. I went to the World Cup last year, watched us get smoked by Wales, which set your watch short, because 4 years before I was in Japan and watched us get not smoked, but beaten by Wales.
Yep.
But at least we made the quarterfinals in that one. So I'm invested. I watch a lot of Super Rugby, love the Queensland Reds, want rugby to do well, but God, they make you work for it. Like, it is not a fun time. And I could see how the majority, as they have switched off. I'm not pinning that down purely just to Wallaby's performance, but it's been blow after blow. 2003 World Cup, awesome, incredible event. We didn't even win. And I think most Australians would be like, yeah, that was awesome. And then you roll on to 07. We play very poorly, get knocked out in the quarters without really firing a shot. And that's okay. Like, you know, you can't win or make the final of every World Cup. But as that's happening, the Bledisloe Cup sorts, you know, that swings against us. We can't buy a Bledisloe. Mm. And that,
I don't know what a Bledisloe is at the moment.
Yeah, I don't have living memory of a Bledisloe. And that, as you've touched upon, as we've both touched upon, like, the Australian market has a lot of good things to offer. Yeah. And if you can watch the Blues play Origin, or your NRL team in a salary cap competition be competitive most years, unless you're a West Tigers fan like me, or AFL has a lot to offer, soccer's done well, football, it's a tough market. And there's not a lot to celebrate.
One difficulty I have with Union is not fully understanding the referee's whistle and in turn the rules that a referee applies. And it affects my enjoyment of the game, because I went to the Australia-Argentina game last year at Parramatta Stadium.
Yep.
It shows how far rugby's gone down that they have to play at Parramatta Stadium.
Nice stadium, though.
But it's lovely, lovely stadium. If you're sitting in the stands, you almost get no insight into what the referee is deciding at a time, and you just clap because you see the referee's hand point a certain way, and you know that's a penalty to the other team or for the Wallabies. Is there scope for rugby to adapt or modernize or change some of its rules to make it a better spectacle? Is it a case that the rules can make the sport better, or is it more an issue with the administrators and making it more popular? I think it's about the rules. Like, if you can make the sport more engaging to watch, you will get more fans wanting to watch your game.
Yeah, I think room for improvement across the board, right?
Yep.
So as you say, exactly right there. I mean, I talked about it in scrum penalties way back when, but it's the exact same problem today. Arm goes up one side or the other, you clap, cool. And look, there's a bit more to it, particularly if you're watching with commentary, it can help. But I was racking my brain thinking, what can actually make rugby better? It's not something I actually think about that much. I sort of just watch and turn off, get on with my day. But I was thinking the NFL.
Yeah.
Okay. You get a penalty flag on the play, cuts to the ref, and they say, number 55, neutral zone infraction. Here's why. And you could even build on that. And I think I want to say, if there's a ruck and for no apparent reason, someone's just been penalized, look, I don't want the ref to be recording a podcast in the middle of the game, but sure, you can, even if they just speak into a mic in their collar, just for the, literally for the purpose of television. I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's entertainment. Like, it's good to keep the fans in the know about what's going on. And they do say why, but it's a couple of words, and that's not enough to say what number it was, what they did wrong, and why you made that decision.
So I love that.
Yeah.
I think that's a great change.
Yeah.
It'll increase the transparency of the sport so that the public understands what rule was infringed, why it was done, and who did it. I want to test two things with you. Would the game be better if you increase the number of free kick outcomes from scrums reduce the number of penalties? Is that a way in which you would improve the sport?
There's one school of thought is that penalties, although I'm about to defer straight back to the other side, but penalties, although they stop the game and they, you know, give a big advantage to one team for getting a penalty, and, you know, obviously they disrupt the flow, is that they're actually a good thing because, you know, a team that's penalizing is doing something wrong. And the more you penalize a team that's doing something wrong, the less they'll do something wrong.
Yeah.
But the reality is you very rarely see a team get penalized, you know, 5 minutes in and go, oh, geez, I just should have stayed on my feet in that ruck. I want to stay on my feet for the whole rest of the game. It's because it's like incredibly difficult sport. Things are happening extremely fast. People get tired and people give away penalties. So I think the whole disincentivizing behavior through penalties, it's obviously always going to be part of the game. Like there's penalties, but it needs to get tweaked. So it's both an interpretation element and a free kick element. You're on the money. That's exactly what I'd down.
Initially, I was of a school of thought, maybe it was a very basic thought, that why don't they reduce the points that you get for a penalty kick, which from 3 to 2, because in some ways it just seems unjust that you score a try, an unconverted try is less than 2 penalty kicks.
100%.
5 points and 2 penalty kicks would be 6 points. But then if you reduce a penalty kick to 2 points, it'll encourage teams to penalize, to infringe more. Because they know the penalty is only 2 points.
See, it's an argument, but I couldn't disagree more. What it might do is make teams who know you can't score a try do that, because they say, well, I'm going to, you know, put my hands in the ruck, or, you know, be a little bit offside because, look, what's the worst that can happen? They could kick a two or they could kick the corner. We can stop them. But what's the knock-on effect of that? The team goes, well, oh, geez, we better start learning how to score some tries.
Yeah.
I think it encourages more attacking.
Yeah,
it's a very narrow idea to think like, oh, penalty stop bad behavior, penalty good. Because what you, like, obviously as a base level, yeah, but actually watch games. What is happening? You get penalty fests. And some refs are better than the others, but there's so many games you watch where it's just like, oh man, the ref is just so involved.
That's what loses fans.
Yes.
If you bring someone who doesn't follow the sport to a game, the way in which you grow a sport is bringing fans who don't follow the sport into a game. You will lose them when the game stops each time for a referee blowing incessantly for a penalty that nobody understands why they blew the penalty for.
And like the growing up, having probably been groups of mates who were more keen on league than union, and you know, trying to get a bit of conversation started on Monday after the Wallabies had a game, you're getting brick wall because everyone's saying, well, rugby, it's just penalties. Well, why would I watch a game scored in lots of three when I can watch league and it's try time?
I agree. You mentioned Super Rugby, probably one of the few
that
watches Super Rugby. But what can be done to the Super Rugby game to make it interesting? Because there've been so many changes. As a person individual that follows it peripherally, I struggle to support it when the concept changes every year.
Yeah.
We had the Jaguares, we had the Pacific yep. Island nations, and then Japan was there, and then yep. it changes. I can't get behind a system that changes every year.
Yeah, look, there's been some steps in the right direction, and there are leaps to be had if it's to actually, you know, have any sort of impact on the sporting community. The format, like, it was brutal towards the end when COVID sort of thankfully disbanded it, not to be disrespectful, but we had a competition which not only covered the entirety of the Southern Hemisphere, also had the Sunwolves.
And Japan, yep.
How can... This isn't a billion-dollar sport. Like, how are you meant to cover that much of the earth in a game which is a real day-to-day financial-wise? Like, it's struggling. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And I'm not just travel expenses, like TV revenue.
Yeah.
You can't... Most of the games weren't on at a time that you could watch it. So as much as I loved all the teams, like, don't get me wrong, like, Argentina having like a national team effect, and there were still players in Europe, but that was awesome. And, you know, the Sunwolves, which they never really took off because Japan still had their own
domestic
comp, which was their pinnacle. So it was kind of this weird sort of a team, but like the fans loved it, and, you know, they had some great games. But, and the South African teams, they're obviously part of Super Rugby's DNA, but it's just practically it just didn't work. And then we moved to just playing Aussie teams, which travel with COVID, but that left you feeling a bit empty. Like, yeah. You can't get by on a 5-team comp. But now we've moved. I'm sure
the South Africans have moved away.
Yeah. No. I think they're getting on all right. Like, but the current format's all right. Like, I think it's as good as we've had in a long time. And I know Super 12 was awesome, but this is as good as we've had since. Like, we've got 5 Aussie teams, 5 Kiwi teams. We got the Fijian Drua and Moana Pacifica.
Okay.
12 teams. It means that you can have 6 games a week in... everyone in the time zones can watch every game.
Yeah.
Travel's not crazy. Now, the level of competition, that's a problem, right? Like, what do you do about that? Because you could take away Aussie sides, but then you need a... 12 teams for me is probably the minimum. Like... Mm. Just in terms of if you're having less than 6 games in a comp on every week, it's a problem. But I think they'll stay with this for a while. There's been no talks of, or once they settle on this, since then, there's not really been any talks of doing away with it. I know that having Australia and New Zealand in the same comp for a while was touch and go, but I think they're always going to stay together because, as I said, like, you can't live on your own as a 5-team comp or a 4 or 5-team comp in Australia.
No.
But... The question is, we've got it now. What needs to be done? The first is, look, Stan Sport, they cover Super Rugby at the moment. They're an improvement on like Foxtel because, like, I don't know, I guess people still have Foxtel, but that's just part of a wider economic shift away from the cable TV in Oz. And that was just it worked okay when there was cable and no streaming services because a lot of Australian families had cable. Not that everyone did, but a lot did. And enough to keep, you know, the game going. Although it always irked me, once again, having that schoolyard chat, being like, oh, yeah, the Waratahs played good. Like, who? Like, what? I'm watching Sunday League, mate.
You can't have a Waratahs chat with anyone nowadays.
Nah, uphill battle.
But you said Stan Sport.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that hurts the sport.
Oh, look.
I think the having rugby behind a paywall and also a streaming platform that is only used for, it's the Australian Netflix essentially, but you need to pay an additional amount to access the sporting streaming platform. And I accessed it just for the Rugby World Cup in 2023, and I removed it. I think that hurts the sport.
Oh, look, in an ideal world, you'd have it on free-to-air, world could see it, happy days. But in terms of what's, actually, and if it was on free-to-air, it would probably be put on like, it wouldn't be put on 9 or so. It would be on
ABC.
I'll take ABC. But one of the, you know, the
channel.
Seven.
Nine Gem or Seven.
Which would be better than Stan Sport. But I don't know. Probably the actual killer with Stan Sport is that, like, unless it's like with pubs, right? and public venues. I think that, I don't know exactly how the licensing system works, but a lot of pubs can only have like certain amount of licenses or channels going within the pub. And like, there's obviously, they're all dedicated to like Sky Racing's one. And then there's might have Free-to-Air and then Foxtel. And that might be the standard. But right. like, I think a lot of pubs do not have the facilities to show rugby, which is a killer because obviously in a crowded market, they're probably going to be playing a league game or even a Swans game or something. But there are times when Sunday Arvo or even the early New Zealand games, 5:30, where there's no other live sport on. It's
rugby
time.
There's a gap.
Yeah. It's live sport. Put it on. I feel like hundreds of thousands might be overestimated, but within Sydney of people that are at a pub on, you know, Friday or Saturdays, it might be that. But
that are willing to watch that.
I know. That would have it. Oh, look, that was a good try. Oh, that's interesting.
That's a really good point. I didn't appreciate that.
Yeah. I've been in that position a few times.
Even a pub, like, because you walk past the pub and there's always big screens and they're showing a sport and you might say, oh, there's a game on. Let me just watch it. And if you're not having that access, then that hurts the sport. I think that's a really good point that probably wasn't appreciated when they accepted a Stan Sports
that's
deal.
Right.
Yeah. At the end of the day, maybe it's the only provider that's willing to pay.
That's right. They made the best offer because, not to get political, but obviously Murdoch has a lot of print media. You may have heard about him. And they were throwing out a lot of arguments about like, oh, how crazy is Rugby Australia to be looking at this Stan deal? It's the great unknown, da da da. Because obviously they just want to sign with Foxtel. Yep. Also a Murdoch entity to keep that gravy train coming in. But we went with Stan and look, as I said, the viewership has gone up. Like that's a fact. But is it a great solution? Like it was a better solution, but it's not a great one.
I suppose in closing, I want to get a sense from you. Are you optimistic as you look at rugby and its future over the next 2 or 3 years? I think we were talking before we started recording about how rugby seems to be really at its apex in Europe and it's thriving in Ireland, in France. France have really, I know they got knocked out in the quarterfinals, but their grassroots level is blossoming.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be popular in England. And I just feel like that sense of optimism doesn't seem to be in Australia, but what's your feeling as we close in terms of rugby's future in Australia?
Yeah, sure. So I'll take it globally first and say, firstly, as a sport, like rugby's great, like rugby's sweet. Like, as you say, globally, there's so much to get around. So many countries getting involved and great markets and a lot of money coming into the game. And to second that, just like professional sport is a great place to be like currently as well. Like, economically as much as anything, but then you put those two elements against the Australian experience and it's like, oh geez, it's like we're at the bottom of a well without a rope. I mean, there's rock bottom, but then there's rock bottom with nowhere to go. In that, I mean, there is a world where the current crop, you know, with some good coaching and, you know, rubber the green, get some results, but like, god, it's just been so long. But like, we're so far away at the moment. And the game is just so small at the moment compared to, the other major codes. It's like, oh, well, I just don't see the way.
I think speaking to you, I feel some form of optimism because we have people like you that are happy to support the domestic rugby scene and watch rugby. And I would consider myself a fair weather fan. I watch a lot of the international games. I love European rugby. I love like keeping up to date on what's happening in the Six Nations and when the Tri Nations are going on, seeing what's happening with Argentina. But I just can't, I don't have the time to follow Super Rugby and domestic rugby in Australia. But I don't know if there's a solution there other than getting more prominence on more free-to-air channels, getting for the athletes to be more exposed. And
oh, that's a huge one.
For the public to see them and for there to be name recognition. I think I struggle a lot now with the current Wallabies crop in even knowing who...
Oh, in this current team.
Who our team is.
Particularly with Quade Cooper and Hooper not being picked. We haven't even gotten into that. Just put out a podcast on that. But yeah, there was no recognition of the team. And yeah, like, that's a killer. I'd be, if I was, you know, head of ARU, I'd be every player contract. It's like, here's your sponsored TikTok account.
Yeah.
Get on there. Like,
yeah,
do some stupid dances. Like, name recognition. Like, I don't even, is that even what like PR is these days? But yeah, like, it's like crying out for it. Like, nice enough bunch of lads, presentable, yeah, but like, no one knows who you are. Get out there. But I will say this, rugby will never die in Australia. It's impossible. It could go like, yeah, look, the administration could go belly up, and there might be some dark times, but when with an amateur, you know, scene as strong as Australia's, and, you know, I'm not going to pretend that there's millions of people like me who are that kind of, but there's a lot. Like, yeah, you go to any Shoot Shield game, there's like thousands of people across, you know, handful of games across Sydney, like getting around it, like diehards. And that's like, those people can't disappear into thin air. And that includes young people. Mm. Like, it's not just yeah, the oldies. It will never die. Like, people say, is Australian rugby dead? It's like, okay, that's obviously like hyperbole. And I get why you say that, but rugby can't die. But it's just in this current form, what's the pathway to success?
I love that. You've given me some hope about the future of the game. Michael, it was great to have you on. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I'm finding when we finish off in a discussion about the modern day environment, sometimes we feel a little down because we look at our sport, we look at this beautiful sport, and now look at Test cricket, for example, Test cricket and rugby union. They sit on this edge of, they will never die in my view, but there is scope for both sports to improve in certain respects and to re-engage with the public.
Yep.
So we'll see, but 2027's around the corner. There'll be a Rugby World Cup in Australia, and who knows, we might be, if I've got a podcast still by that time, we might be talking about how rugby union is the major sport in winter. Michael, thanks for your time, and it was great talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lovely.